Hello, this is Utah Phillips, the golden voice of the Great Southwest, and you are indeed listening to Loafer's Glory, the hobo jungle of the mind. Were you thinking that those were the words? Those upright lines, those curves, angles, dots? No, those are not the words. The substantial words are in the ground and sea. They are in the air. They are in you. Well, here we are again, Loafer's Glory, the hobo jungle of the mind, and this is, in fact, Utah Phillips, the golden voice of the Great Southwest. We are in the studios of our community radio station here in Nevada City, KVMR, the voice of the Sierra foothills, where we live benignly in a community of sentiment and not an age of information. Yes, this is my hometown now. I have been for about 11, 12 years, Nevada City. It's a tourist mecca for those seeking relief from Sacramento, Fresno, places too fierce to mention. We're going to be talking, singing, demonstrating storytelling. I'm not going to talk a lot about storytelling. If there's one thing in American cultural life right now that's being over-examined, it's storytelling. I mean, academia is committed to hammering the magic out of storytelling just by over-examining it, all right? So we're going to do it. We're not going to examine it a whole lot. Besides which, it isn't in the hands of other people. It's in your hands. As I've always said, you got to learn to sing your own song, to dance your own dance, to tell your own story. Your life is a story. The most you can hope for is that at the end it will have been well told. Keith Marsden, English fella, lived in the north, the industrial north of England, those grimy, soot-covered industrial towns. Keith Marsden was a songwriter. He's passed away now. He did leave behind a songbook called Picking Sooty Blackberries. One of his songs, however, is about a legendary storyteller in that part of the world. And I have his song, Keith Marsden's song called Jack Ashton. You'll hear it sung by Finest Kind.
Oh, the times were odd and mean, and our youthful days were lean, in the land they said was fit for Flanders heroes. It was all a seaside show where the poor folk couldn't go. We just stood outside while others watched the pierrots. And we only had to spend what our friend Sam Clegg would lend. There was little of Lloyd George's promised glory. But each evening down the street, by the gas lamp we would meet, and we'd listen while Jack Ashton told his stories. Aye, we sat there and listened with our mouths open wide, though we knew in our hearts that the old devil lied. But we needed to believe in the magic he would weave, so we took a glass for old time's sake the day Jack died. Now our all-wise parents said he'd a screw loose in the head, and that we was daft to listen to his lies. But we saw their daily grind and heard the magic in his mind, and we knew who was daft and who was wise. Though we nearly broke our necks playing soccer on the rec. And his bowling with a corky could be gory. As the evening sun went down, by the lamp we'd gather round, and we'd listen while Jack Ashton told his stories. Aye, we sat there and listened with our mouths open wide, though we knew in our hearts that the old devil lied. But we needed to believe in the magic he would weave. So we took a glass for old time's sake, the day Jack died. Now that Jack's been laid to rest, if there's any justice left, he'll be telling yarns now to the Holy Ghost. I ungathered round his knee, open-mouthed as we might be. Sit saints and angels, all the heavenly host. And he'd tell them how he saved old Moses from the wave, and he slew Goliath with one mighty blow. As an all-forgiving Lord listened smiling at his words, as we did by the gas lamp long ago. Aye, we sat there and listened with our mouths open wide, though we knew in our hearts that the old devil lied. But we needed to believe in the magic he would weave. So we took a glass for old time's sake, the day Jack died.
Jack Ashton, finest kind, isn't that wonderful? Well, what is the story here? I have to talk quickly because I'm on the lam from the Bad Taste Police. Normally I work with a built-in quality control officer who, much to my chagrin, has an ironclad contract and is off on vacation. But I feel that I can still say pretty much what I please as long as I talk quickly and keep track of where the exits are. Most of the tales I tell began as rude, throwaway bar jokes people told me, more often than not violent, racist, and sexist bar jokes. Why on earth anyone would believe that I like to hear this blather absolutely eludes me. But many of them, nonetheless, contain a hard nugget of comic value. The idea is to listen patiently, grasp the nugget, wipe the crud off, divest it of its vile criminal context, and reclothe it in a raiment more suitable to a formerly reptilian prince. I am no mere storyteller. I champion the degraded and downtrodden gag. I am on a rescue mission which, once accomplished, transforms blatant theft into high art. Well, there were three of us. The best storytelling I ever heard, shared, was the three of us got together at workshops all over the country at folk festivals. There was myself and then the two that I met when I first came east from Utah. Marshall Dodge, a down east storyteller, did the main stories as well as they can possibly be done. That's real understated humor. Then, of course, there was Gamble Rogers from down in Florida. Now, he wasn't a Southerner. He was a Floridian, and you're from Florida, know what I mean. An elegant gentleman who sculpted language, who crammed more good language into better sentences than I ever heard. And then there was me, the odd man out, doing Well, Gamble did the Southern Gothic love stories, sort of. I did the exaggerated Western kind of storytelling, the tall tales. And all we went round and around and talked about how they were put together. You're going to listen to one of them from Marshall Dodge. He passed away in a bicycle accident, you know. He was a disciple of the bicycle. He had a bicycle with big fat rims that he'd put on abandoned railroad track up in Maine, and he'd pedal along there for miles and miles. Sometimes he'd put a sail up. I first saw him sitting there backwards on a bicycle seat with the sail up, skimming along the track, eating cheese and drinking wine out of a hamper in between the two bicycles. Well, he got killed in Hawaii. Of course, Gamble Roger. Then again, a story I first heard Marshall Dodge tell. Now, when he passed away, nobody would touch his stories, you know, because he was very jealous. He guarded them very jealously. But finally, Kendall Morris, another great Down East storyteller, he wrote a letter to all of the storytellers and said, those stories can't die. Now, I'm declaring open season on him. So I take him at his word. I took one of those stories and twisted it around, just like I said there, and I took it over. I made it my own. I turned it into a Western story. And then we're going to listen to Gamble Rogers. Gamble, well, he was in a boating accident down there in Florida trying to save somebody's life. The undertow took him away. You know, I missed the company of those two sitting on the same stage, just sitting around in a room and swapping yarns. So we're going to listen to Marshall Dodge do Aunt Mehitable. We'll listen to all these together. Marshall Dodge doing Aunt Mehitable, me doing Oliver's Outhouse, which is a Marshall Dodge story retold, and then we're going to listen to Gamble Rogers doing the Sky Lake Campfire Girls.
And then there was Aunt Mehitable. Bless her heart. She was a card from a long line of cards, she was. And she said she was going to get out to California before she died. Well, she just made it. Well, she got out there and she wired us that she'd had a very pleasant trip to California, that she'd gone by way of Bangor, but that she did not like California on account of it was so far from the ocean. And she said she was heading back east as fast as she could. Well, she got on the train and got as far as Sacramento when she come down with the cholera mobilis and on top of that, the tizic. The cholera mobilis will fell an ox, but it took the tizic to drop Aunt Mehitable. She passed away on the train and we wired the station master to crate her up and ship her east. And she arrived 5 days later at Cutler Siding. We rushed her through the funeral services. It was the middle of August. Then we got her out to the graveyard and was about to lower her away when curiosity got the best of us and we pried up aboard to have a last look-see, and there, inside, was an admiral in full dress uniform, making the best of an unsettling situation. We lowered the admiral and buried him quick, in the hopes that somewhere Aunt Mehitable would be getting a 21-gun salute.
Colonel Charlie Goodnight and Oliver Loving, pioneer settlers of the old Southwest and folk heroes, both of them, founders of the great Goodnight Loving Trail, the westernmost of the great cattle trails from El Paso, Texas to Denver with a spur into Montana. Now, in years past, I have come right in front of many of you and talked about the great turtle drive of 86, talked about the egg-setting horse, and if you missed that one, well, it was a rare beauty.
the story about their middle years. Colonel Goodnight was old, 55, 56 years old. Oliver Lovin was 45 or so. They were quartered in Taos, New Mexico in those days. Colonel Goodnight was a rancher, so he built a beautiful house in town. Oliver was a wrangler. He handled the remuda, the horses that traveled with any herd. So he had to corral them outside of town, where he built himself a little cabin. And along with it, he built a brand new one-hole outhouse. Do you still have outhouses hereabouts at all? Something seldom looked into, outhouses. Well, it was a beautiful, brand-new hickory seat. On it had a regular gewgaw, gym crack, there on the seat. You'd sit there and turn this crank, and it would run a little fan down inside to keep the flies off your butt during the summer. It's a catalog item. You can still get them. Well, now, he wanted to weatherproof that seat, so he put two new coats of spar varnish on it and then went into town to visit. But not anticipating visitors, he neglected to put a wet paint sign on the door. Colonel Goodnight loped up looking for Oliver Lovin, and I do mean Colonel Goodnight, a man of vast and consummate dignity, silvered of mane and furrowed of brow and eagle of eye and hawk of beak and thin of lip and lantern of jaw, ramrod of spine, level of shoulder, firm of grip, swivel of hip, lean of shank, fleet of foot, the whole nine yards. He was a picture of the old West. Cast about for Oliver, couldn't find him, spied the new outhouse, decided to run some field trials on it, went in and took a seat to smoke a bowl and do some reading. Well, he was there for the better part of 4 hours, lodged fast. By the time Oliver got back, he was down there bellering, madder than a boiled owl, pretty mad. Well, don't worry about it, Charlie. Oliver could call him Charlie. He hot-footed up to the cabin, got some paint spatulas, some screwdrivers, a mallet hammer, crowbar, a sledgehammer in case the exigency got dire. Went down there, started poking and prodding around Colonel Goodnight, him bellowing all the while. Couldn't loosen him, stuck fast, decided to seek some professional advice. Well, with the sledgehammer, he knocked off the front of the outhouse. Then with the crowbar, he levered the seat up, but the colonel poked through it, kind of hove the whole thing over one shoulder and lugged it out and flung it up onto Colonel Goodnight's horse with the colonel poked skyward, led the whole affair down through town. Hi, Jake. Hi, Al. Greeting his friends. Up to the doc's office. Well, the doc come out and walked all the way around the horse two or three times. Oliver said, well, Doc, you ever see anything like that? Doc said, why, yes, I have, but not with a frame around it.
You know, there wasn't a whole lot shaking up there in the Coochie Valley when we came along. In fact, I do not believe that me and my boy cousins would have made it through had it not have been for the Sky Lake Campfire Girl. Yep, about every third Saturday we'd hear the sylvan, tendersweet, birdsong flitterings of the Sky Lake Campfire Girls steaming down the valley, stuffed into that steak body truck, just a shimmering rainbow panoply of prepubescent pulchritude. Singing those wonderful old Campfire Girl songs like I wish I was a fishy in the sea. Not swimmy and not scooty without no bathing suity. Oh, I wish I was a fishy in the sea. And I stand before you tonight, mortally embarrassed to admit that these half-baked, sophomoric sentiments absolutely drove us wild. For you see, we were just young pups, growing boys. All of us had been simultaneously smitten with that all-pervasive, intransigent, overwhelming escalation of the sap of bloodlust. Now, there's nothing wrong with it. We were just growing up. But don't you remember how confusing it was to go through puberty? Going through puberty's like the first time you ever held a boa constrictor. In a situation like that, you don't know whether you're holding a snake or that mother's holding you. But you flat know something's got you. Now, we figured maybe if we could spy on those campfire girls, we might find out what it was had hold of us. Now, they always roasted marshmallows and weenies down by my granddaddy's spring. Us boys would flit out of the house. We'd ghost from tree to tree. Then we'd hit the dirt, and we'd inch along in the manner of amorous angleworms. We would attain the high ground, spread that penultimate spray of greenery, and look down upon that smorgasbord of sensuality. And it was there, lying in close communion with Mother Earth, that I sustained my first great revelation regarding sex. Which was simply that I was lying ankle to Adam's apple in poison ivy. And I ain't never been able to look at a campfire girl since without scratching.
That's my old friend Gamble Rogers doing it. And then myself and Marshall Dodge. Oh, it was always so much fun. Hey, you know, it occurred to me as I was sitting here that that little poem I did at the beginning, I didn't tell you who that was. That was from Walt Whitman. And in case you forgot what it was, I'll do it again for you. Were you thinking that those were the words, those upright lines, those curves, angles, dots? No, those are not the words. The substantial words are in the ground and sea. They are in the air. They are in you. Yeah, Walt Whitman. 1932, World War I vets. This is in the depths of the Depression. World War I vets. Many of them unemployed, lost their homes, lost their farms. They'd been promised a bonus of $50 to $100, a veteran's bonus. But Congress postponed that until 1945. Well, all these vets got together, they called the bonus marchers, they descended on Washington, D.C., and they had lived in poverty. They converged on Washington, 25,000 men, women, and children to lobby Congress for the bonuses, set up a shanty town near Pennsylvania Avenue. The slogan was, "Heroes in 17, Bums in 32. Well, the troops, the tanks, machine guns, gas, all sent in there. They destroyed the camp. A reporter asked the commander about a man having his ear slashed off by a bayonet. He replied, "You don't slash with a saber, you lunge." The commander was General Douglas MacArthur. His second in command was Colonel Dwight D. Eisenhower. Of course, General Douglas MacArthur was fired by President Harry Truman, probably the only rational act Mr. Truman performed during his entire tenure of office. He fired him for, all kinds of things, insubordination and talking back, but mainly I think the idea was he wanted to drop atomic bombs across the Yalu River onto China and start World War III there during the Korean War. Well, MacArthur came back to a hero's welcome. He spoke up in front of Congress. You know, I heard that speech, and it was a very moving speech. And I was moved. This is a guy that damn near killed me. But it was a very moving speech. We're going to listen to just a little bit of that speech, General Douglas MacArthur's farewell speech to Congress.
I am closing my 52 years of military service. When I joined the Army, even before the turn of the century, it was the fulfillment of all my boyish hopes and dreams. The world has turned over many times since I took the oath on the plane at West Point. And the hopes and dreams have long since vanished. But I still remember the refrain of one of the most popular barrack ballads of that day, which proclaimed most proudly that old soldiers never die. They just fade away. And like the old soldier of that ballad, I now close my military career and just fade away. An old soldier who tried to do his duty as God gave him the light to see that duty. Goodbye.
General Douglas MacArthur. Well, I'll tell you, there wasn't a dry leg in the house that day. Control yourself, Utah. Look, let's go to an intermission now to give you a chance to catch your breath. Kenny Hall doing that intermission music. Boy, I love that man. I love to listen to the way he plays. He plays with great joy. Why would I, who have, well, I have respect, but not a great deal of liking of General Douglas MacArthur, play his voice on a program like this? It's an American voice. The sound of American speech and it's all of its variety. And oh, I love it that the regional dialects persist in asserting themselves. That richness that gets mulched into television language, that great leveling influence that gets everybody talking the same. I love lurking around the country and hearing those voices. You know, Woody Guthrie, he regarded himself as an eavesdropper, and he had an ear for those voices. He said it'd be like he was standing waiting for a bus, listening to the people talk around him. And in their common everyday talk would be these ringing phrases that would pound on his ear until he torqued them around, put near rhymes on the end of the lines, and come out with those marvelous songs. American voices. Let's listen to a couple more of those. Norman Thomas, there's a voice you don't hear. Used to hear him a lot. Don't hear him much anymore. This is a recording, an old LP from the Serramonte High School in Daly City. It was sort of phased out, you know, because nobody knew what it was anymore. Norman Thomas was a theologian. He was a social worker. He was a pacifist and a socialist, a founder of the American Civil Liberties Union. Now, as a socialist, he ran for governor of New York and mayor of New York City twice each, and for president of the United States six times. Norman Thomas got 900,000 votes in 1932. Well, the last time around, he declined to run. He said the platform of the Socialist Party had been realized by reforms under President Franklin D. Roosevelt. In other words, the socialists won by not winning. We're going to listen first to a little short story by Robert Bryan, the other half of Bert and I used to work with Marshall Dodge. Robert Bryan doing a little piece called Socialism, a Down East story, and then the voice of Norman Thomas.
Eben Robay went down to the Tremont Temple in Boston one Saturday night to hear Norman Thomas speak. Next Monday, he was preaching socialism to Enoch Turner, over the back fence. You know, Enoch, he was saying, Under socialism, a person shares everything.
You mean to say, Eben, that if you had two farms, you'd give me one of them?
Yep. If I had two farms, Enoch, I'd give you one of them.
You mean to say, Eben, that if you owned two hay ricks, you'd give me one of them?
Yep. If I had two hay ricks, I'd give you one of them.
Or if you had two hogs, Eben, would you give me one of them?
Dan, you Enoch, you know I got two hogs.
It's not an unhappy life, I assure you, to stand for what you believe and fight for it. It has its own compensations, its own satisfactions, which aren't to be despised at all. By and large, I'm inclined to think that we socialists didn't throw away our votes under our two-party system, especially in the years when we were active. Because we voted as we did, we had more influence on bringing about the changes that came with the New Deal than a lot of people that conventionally voted Democratic in Mississippi or Republican in Maine. That seems to me to be very obvious. So that when I talk about young people in politics, I say this. There has to be some new formulation of ideals and programs in our bewildering world in which change has been so breathtaking. Some new formulation, but along lines that are familiar, along lines of democracy and of justice that we've always cared about. It's a tremendous challenge to try to help to make that. And if in making it you offer yourself for public office and are elected, you can greatly serve. But you can also serve sometimes if you're defeated, and you can also serve if you're never even a candidate. To give a rather conspicuous example, at least in the city of New York, a lawyer named C.C. Burlingham died at the age of 100-odd, I don't know when. One of the most remarkable men I ever knew. Now, he wasn't a socialist. He was a liberal. He was an exceedingly honest, witty, intelligent man with a marvelous memory of the past. He was behind almost every decent movement here in New York. I don't think he ever even tried to be elected. He was a counselor to judges. Supreme Court judges would stop off in his old age to talk to him. It was a benediction. Well, that's the wrong word. It was an inspiration of a sort to go to see him, as I occasionally did. I'm not saying this because I agreed with everything he said or that he agreed with me. But that's a kind of man we need more of. He was a man of certain peculiar talents. But the general idea, we won't have our democracy unless there are people who are willing to pay quite a price in hard effort. Democracy is, a good democracy is not a simple and an instinctive thing. It requires work, it requires education, it requires effort, it requires capacity to cooperate with others. Which means, if you like, sometimes you compromise, because even in a family, you can't get along by saying, like Luther, here stand I could do no other, so help me God, all the time. You may have to say it once in a while. Politics is, in a sense, the art of compromise, but it's the art of compromise of people who have a sense of direction, who know where they're going, and who don't compromise too easily without a fight, as so often happens. It's by politics that we'll have peace or war in the end. No matter how much goodwill there is suffused, it's by politics that you will make an end of the legal discriminations against colored Americans and others. It's by politics that we'll come to grips with questions like, well, in the end, even birth control and the explosion of population, with all kinds of economic problems, with the proper guarding of our diminishing natural resources, with the proper extension of our technology, with the proper conquest of poverty throughout the world.
Thank you very much, Mr. Norman Thomas.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Norman Thomas. You know, that's what he just articulated there at the end was his whole program, the whole Socialist Party program ever since its inception. They were talking about birth control, talking about environmentalism, you see. I only saw the man once. It was in the early 60s. He died in the 60s. It was in the early 60s, and it was at a peace rally in Washington, D.C. He was invited there to speak. Getting out of a taxi cab, he had gotten his coat slammed in the door when the cab pulled away. It dragged him a considerable distance. But there he was, standing up, all battered, bruised all down one side of his face and down his body, speaking to us about peace. Judy Berry, here's another American voice. That's the really American voice. Judy Berry up there in the Redwoods, trying to save the Redwoods and trying to build a movement that was going to behave more sensibly toward the common treasury, to what we all own together. Judy Berry, she's the one, for those of you out there who don't remember, whose car was bombed May 24th, 1990, and she was very, very seriously wounded. She has since passed away of breast cancer. Well, Judy was the one who said, "Analysis is deeper than environmental assessment, deeper than corporatism." And to illustrate that, here's a little speech that she gave up at the Willits Environmental Center June 14, 1996, and it is called "Francis Bacon Was a Pig."
Anyone who's ever dealt with the Forest Service or the California Department of Forestry or Endangered Species Act or anything like that knows that the science is used as the authority for the kind of relentless assault on nature of this society. And science is presented to us as neutral, as an objective path to knowledge, as something that's value-free. But science is not value-free. The scientific methods, there's not just one method, despite what we were taught in science class. There's not just one method. And the methodology of Western science is not value-free at all. In fact, it was openly described by its founders as a masculine system that presupposes the separation of people from nature and presupposes our dominance over nature. And I want to give you some quotes to let you know why this is so. This going back to the origin of the scientific method and all those things way back in the 1600s in the Renaissance period. And first of all, one of the initiation of the scientific method, the elevation of this as absolute truth and the only path to truth, this was begun in like 1664, for example. There was something that was called the Royal Society, and it was composed of all these scientific men who were developing these theories. And they described their goal, this is a quote, "to raise a masculine philosophy whereby the mind of men may be ennobled with the knowledge of solid truths." I'll give you another example. This is from the aptly named Sir Francis Bacon. he was one of the worst. He was actually pretty shocking. He said that the scientific method is a method of aggression. And here's his quote. "The nature of things betrays itself more readily under vexation than in its natural freedom. Science is not merely a gentle guidance over nature's course. We have the power to conquer and subdue her, to shake her to her foundations. And that the purpose of doing this is to create a blessed race of heroes who would dominate both nature and society." So, you know, you don't go back to these philosophical roots of science very often, but this is the roots of the scientific method that's now approved by the CDF to justify their clear cuts. The rise of the scientific method, of this masculine method of knowledge, went along at the same time period with the very violent suppression of the women's knowledge, of the knowledge of the earth, of the herbal ways, and things like that. So this wasn't just, oh, we have a better way, you women stand aside. It was, we're going to burn you at the stake. So, you know, it was certainly not neutral. It was a very aggressive imposition of a masculine system of knowledge. But in order to find a balance in this society is hugely out of balance. And in order to find that balance, we would have to see a huge rise of the feminine. Both a rise of individual women and also a rise of feminist ideology among both women and men. But without this balance between the masculine and the feminine, society, I don't believe, we cannot make the changes that we need to come back into balance with the earth.
Judy Berry. I got news that Judy Berry had passed away as a backstage at the Trumbull Theater in Detroit doing a benefit for the striking newspaper workers there. And it shook me down to my socks. I had to go on the stage then, and I sat down in a chair and I told him the story of her, and then I told him the story of Mother Jones. And that's a story that I recorded recently with Ani DiFranco, Mother Jones.
I was traveling through Illinois when I was invited to stop and sing at a memorial there in the little town of Mount Olive. Now, who of note in American history is buried in the cemetery in Mount Olive, Illinois? I'll give you a hint. It was a woman. It was the Union Miners Cemetery. Do you have it yet? Mary Harris. Mary Harris Jones. Mother Jones. It's hard for the mind to encompass a life that embraced the presidencies between Andrew Jackson and Herbert Hoover. Why, when Mother Jones was a little girl, there were people still alive who remembered the Revolutionary War. And she died on the eve of the New Deal. Her millinery shop burned down in the Chicago fire, and she had heard Abraham Lincoln speak in person. Mostly, though, Mother Jones was the miner's friend. Down in Kentucky, Tennessee, West Virginia. Well, the men had been organizing the underground workers, the miners. Mother Jones had already organized their wives and led them over the snow-covered game trails down into the Hollis, where, armed with mops and brooms, they drove the scabs out of the coal pits. Now, Mother Jones wasn't an organizer, she was an agitator, which meant often enough she was hated as much by the organizers as by the bosses. One time, Mother Jones was out in Colorado at the great Ludlow strike. Now, that was a strike to enforce the 8-hour day, which the state of Colorado had made a law, but they couldn't enforce it because Rockefeller owned the militia. Now, the governor promised not to send the militia into the coal fields, but he lied, and he did. Mother Jones was in the Union Hall down there at Ludlow, and word came that the militia had entered the coal fields. Well, she leapt up, and she screamed, "Let's go get the sons of bitches!" And she stormed out. She didn't look to see if anybody was following her. Nobody was following her. She just flounced up the road alone and confronted the militia. And that was the year that President Theodore Roosevelt called Mother Jones the most dangerous woman in America. And she was 83 years old. That's some kind of dangerous.
Annie DeFranco, what a privilege it was to work with her. Stories are made out of words, and they're made out of voices. One of my favorite pastimes is wordplay. You probably surmised that. There's somebody up in Winnipeg, Canada, came up after a performance I did there, and he said, over in Germany, they call what you do Wieselstück. It's an addiction to wordplay, an addiction to puns. And oh, I tell an enormous number of really fabulous puns. Tell me about that. Write me a letter. Say, is there such a thing as Wieselstück? Is that right? What does that mean? Well, let's listen to some wordplay. Just wordplay right now. Les Barker. This is his Go Stay and Fetch.
I'd always wanted a dog. So one day I took in a stray. He didn't want to leave me, and so I called him Stay. I knew it was a mistake. The first time I told Stay to go. Go, Stay! And I pointed, but did Stay go? No. Go, Stay, I said, and he started. He was going, and then he was not. He looked at me sad and confused. And two big eyes said, "What?" I threw him a stick. I said, "Fetch, stay." He started and stopped all in one. I never got round to come here, stay. Stay couldn't come, he'd not gone. He wanted to please, but he couldn't. I spoke, but he just didn't know. So I got him a spaniel for company. I shouldn't have called it. I said, "Stay, go." And go would stay a second, then both stay and go were away. I had to shout, "Come here, stay and go." They were coming and going all day. I said, "Stay, go and stay." I tried go, stay and go. Nothing seemed to get through. It's not they were both saying no. They were both saying, "Does he mean you?" It's all very well in the park, but what if we stood at the curb? Two lost souls in the dark. Which bloody one is the verb? I've got him a new friend now. I found him, a poor starving wretch. I hope they'll be very happy together. Go and stay, come and meet Fetch.
Wordplay. Mahatma Gandhi urged hand spinning and weaving as a way to fight against the abysmal poverty of the Indian villages. He said, "The spinning wheel is itself a machine. What I object to is the craze for machinery, not machinery as such. The craze is for what they call labor-saving machinery. We go on saving labor until thousands are thrown on the open streets to die of starvation." Everywhere Gandhi went, he and his minions spun and spun. Let's listen to a story about Mahatma Gandhi, done by Lord Buckley with Turk Murphy's jazz band, the Hip Mahatma.
Now here's the way the whole scene went down. The lion was bugging India. Every time India get a little extra scarf in the cupboard, the lion swooped the scene, and there stands the poor Indian scarfless. That was up until the day that the Hip Mahatma blew in on the scene. And the day that the Hip Mahatma blew in on that scene, that lion was into that scoffing cupboard, up to his shoulders, flipping and flapping his tail, trying to grab that low bolt, de-gigged the whole supply. So the Hip Mahatma backed away a little bit, and he hold out his arms real wide, and he do one of them long Indian broad jumps, and pow! Stomped on that cat's tail so hard he swooped the scene, and that's the last I done see of him from that day to this. Naturally, that gassed Indian. Well, in return, they want to gas again. So Mr. Rabidi, the hippotrill of India, he said, "I'd notice all the Indian musicians do the bang bang blitz, the nang nang blitz, doom doom blitz, the boom boom blitz, and the lute heads and the flute heads and the reed heads, and every cat could knock a rock together." He said, "Come on in, we're going to gas again." So here they come flipping and flapping over hill and dale, singing great songs and stuff with jam sessions here and there. And the birds are flying along to one side, singing crazy songs from. And they're flipping on down to this big palladium football field where they're gonna blow all this wild jazz for the all-hip Mahatma. And they now got 4 acres of musicians. That's a lot of jazz. And before they blow the note, Mr. Rabbity, the hippotriller, stand up in front of all these cats and he say, "Boys, you know what to blow when the saint comes marching in." They said, "Cuckoo." So here come the all hip Mahatma. And he got on a nice clean white dow-dow, and the love light is shining out in his eyes. And he got 27 chicks with horn-rimmed glasses, 14 nanny goats, and 16 spinning wheels. And he comes swanging down right in the middle of the arena. And the cooler nanny goats, and the cooler chicks, and the cooler spinning wheels, and the cooler all-hip Mahatma, and all these cats start to wail. Hip! To cats and kittens, heard many a far-out jam session, but you never heard anything like these cats wail for the gang. They were so crazy and so insane that the snakes in the jungle picked up on the beat, come stomping in, had to send out the snake guard saying, "No dancing tonight, boys. We just blowing for the all-hip Mahatma." And I had to send around the wig tappers, tapping the cats' wigs back on, said, "Jack, I can't get this wig on. Back on you, it's going in the same hole. Say, gotta cool it for a little bit." That's how wild it was. When they got all through, Mr. Rabbity, the hippotrill of India, he walk up to the great all-hip Mahatma and he say, "Oh, great swinging rock and roller, to rock all rock and rollers." And the all-hip Mahatma say, "Well, baby, if I ain't, I'm a big fat tough pole on a bad hill on the way there." See how hip the cat was? He said, "Did you dig this scene, sweet double hipness?" And the all-hip Mahatma said, "Baby, when I heard all them bam bam blaze, nang nang blaze, boom boom blaze, ding ding blaze, lute heads and flute heads and reed heads and rock knockers, said it brought to me the glory and the beauty of Mother India." So Mr. Rabbity say, "Well, sweet double hipness, boys and I like to twist our wig loose getting this scene straight for you. Would you do us a little favor?" And the hip Mahatma say, "Course I will, baby." Say, "Would you tell us of all the instruments you heard this evening, which instrument do you dig the most?" And the hip Mahatma say, "Well, baby, it's..." He said, "The instrument that I digs the most, you ain't got it." He said, "Man, what are you talking about? The nang nang blade, the boom boom blade, the ning ning blade, the nang nang blade, and the lute heads, and the flute heads, and the reed heads, and every cat can knock a rock together. And this cat tell me the instrument he digs the most, we ain't got here." "That's right." So, "Well, sweet double hipness, straighten me, cause I'm ready." So they all hit my heart and said, "Baby, the music of all India, the instrument which swings my soul into an orchestration of great love and beauty, he says the sound of the..." "The spinning wheel, baby. Knock a patch on the little cat's pants. Swing a coat on grandma. Get a little man of Chevis on the table." He said, "The spinning wheel, baby. I hope I didn't bang you down." Mr. Rabbity said, "No, sweet double hipness, you have moonstoned me." And they hit my heart and say, "Solid. Pass the sake."
Well, I continue to be Utah Phillips, the golden voice of the great Southwest, and you have been listening to Loafer's Glory, the hobo jungle of the mind. From Carl Sandburg. I got a zoo. I got a menagerie inside my ribs, under my bony head, under my red valve heart. And I got something else. It is a man-child heart, a woman-child heart. It is a father, mother, and lover. It came from God knows where. It is going God knows where. For I am the keeper of the zoo. I say yes and no. I sing and kill and work. I'm a pal of the world. I came from the wilderness.